Hi, this is Cecily Armstrong. Thank you for listening to this week's show on your favorite podcast platform. You can go to our website, grapesgrainscrub.com, for pictures, stories, recipes, music, and extras about this episode and other episodes, delicious travel ideas, my culinary picks, and a lot more. Okay, so let's get started. I hope you enjoy this week's episode. You're listening to Grapes, Grains, and Grub, where we believe agriculture tastes good and have conversations with the culinary evangelists who fill our plates, bellies, and souls. We also reveal delicious travel destinations. I'm your host, Cecily Armstrong. Today, my special guest is Jess Baker. She is the editor-in-chief of craftbeer.com. Now, did you know that in 2018, the craft brewing industry made up 13% of the U.S. beer market by volume? That's 27 billion, as in B, as in beer. It's a lot of money. She's going to tell us more about that. As a longtime journalist, she's now crafting stories about America's small and independent breweries, and boy, does she have some stories to tell. You may think you know what craft beer is, but wait until you hear the real story about the rapid growth that the craft beer industry is experiencing now and how it's affecting towns across America, agribusiness, and the economy. I also ask her about the multiculturalism that craft beer represents, the unexpected Rust Belt revitalization, and she gives us her picks for some really cool craft beer travel destinations right now.
Wherever small breweries go, they tend to be part of a cultural revitalization because they bring people back to those areas. They bring manufacturing back to the areas. So it really does create an economic impact in our communities here in America.
Later in the show, we reveal this episode's culinary destination and my picks this week, including avocado hippie snacks that people are going crazy for, including me, and a couple of other items that I'm really loving right now. But before we get to my conversation with Editor-in-Chief Jess Baker, here's our weekly Front of House segment with entertaining and hospitality expert, you know him, Robert Rodriguez. He's sharing his professional inside scoop and tips about the importance of seating during your next dinner or event. Taking us from front of house to your house on every episode of Grapes, Grains, and Grub. I'm so excited you're in the studio again today.
Me too.
Okay, so we're going to get right to it because this is probably one of the most important things that people don't think about, and that's seating. And of course, you in your world, your professional world, it's important, but I'm worried that like people don't think about this at home.
So it's important at home to consider where are people going to sit. Sometimes you want to encourage standing and mingling and interacting with people, but if you want people to be truly comfortable, you need to make sure you have arrangements for people to sit. So seating when designing a restaurant or when you're looking at entertaining spaces at home, you know, professionally speaking, in a restaurant environment, you're looking at several different things. You're looking at, first of all, comfort. Also, what's practical as far as what's going to fit in the space, what is appropriate color and texture wise in the space, what you have room to store. And that's true at home, too. You know, you get into the conversation about big, cushy, comfortable couches and or chairs, which are great in lounge settings where you want people to hang out for a long time. But you also need some tall seating and some hard surfaces where you don't necessarily want people hanging out all the time. That way you have a variety of different textures and comfort levels in the same space. People gravitate towards what is good for them, what's familiar for them, and it's good to have options for them. So when you're entertaining at home, if it's people that you're familiar with, you're obviously thinking about any dietary restrictions or special needs that they may have from a food and beverage perspective. And please don't forget to extend that to their comfort level as far as where they're sitting, where do they prefer to stand, whether they need a comfy chair or whether they need something that's hard and sturdy. People definitely have preferences and definitely have, and you know, some people have some special needs and need to be accommodated. And if you're doing a seated dinner around a table and you know your guests very well and you know who's left-handed and right-handed, keep that in mind too. There's no limit to what you can provide to make the guests comfortable. Also consider when planning an event at home, you know, what is the purpose of the event? Do you need seating? Do you want people up standing around talking to each other, interacting because they don't really know each other very well? Or do you want people to be able to kind of sit down and have their space and still interact with the guests, but not be required to do that because they can't find a place to sit?
Well, Robert, I have been sitting here in my comfortable chair.
On the edge of your seat.
On the edge of my seat. This is so good. Thank you so much for coming to the studio, sharing your knowledge and information. And listeners, I know that you learned something once again from our intrepid Robert Rodriguez in front of house. Thanks for coming in.
Time to get back to work.
I am so thrilled about my guest today. She is Jess Baker, and she is the editor-in-chief of craftbeer.com. Now everybody's ears are perking up out there. Okay. So craftbeer.com is a website for beer lovers, and it's published by the Brewers Association. They're the trade group that protects and promotes small and independent U.S. brewers. Now, while the Brewers Association's focus is supporting its members, craftbeer.com focuses on telling the stories about those breweries to beer lovers. The BA is really a very cool organization, and it's based in Boulder, Colorado. So after 15 years in digital and broadcast journalism, Jess Baker is now the editor-in-chief of craftbeer.com. She and her talented team are bringing you the stories about America's small and independent breweries. Okay, so she's a runner, but I'm guessing that's because, you know, she probably drinks a lot of beer. We're going to find out. She's a diehard Springsteen fan, which immediately makes me like her. We love the boss. And she's also a new mom. And so she's always scouting family-friendly breweries. So hi, Jess.
Hi, Cecily. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. I'm so thrilled you're on today. So let's tell our audience directly from the source. Explain, if you will, kind of the short definition of what a craft brewer is. So what qualifies as a craft brewer?
Yeah. So a craft brewer is, as the Brewers Association defines it, is small, which means they make less than 6 million barrels of beer each year.
Okay.
And independent. So less than 25% of the brewery is owned or controlled by a beverage alcohol industry member that is not itself a craft brewer. So small and independent are truly what defines a craft brewer here in the United States.
So really, I'm imagining that means a lot of families, a lot of family-owned businesses, probably
bingo,
friends going into partnership together.
Absolutely.
A lot of passion.
Yes, all those things. And that's something that really attracted me to the industry itself. I was working in news and weather for a long time. And when I tripped into a craft beer festival in Atlanta, probably around 2008, 2009, and I grew up around beer. My dad is a lifelong beer lover. But by 2009 and that beer festival, I didn't realize that's what beer in America was becoming. It was becoming craft beer and owned exactly like you said, by family and friends and people who get together and start a business out of passion for beer. And I was like, this is beer now?
Right.
I was so enchanted by the idea that you could own a business and make beer for a living. Like, how cool is that?
Yeah. And to be the editor-in-chief of the definitive website for that is pretty cool. You know, as you're describing it, I'm thinking about, you know, I lived in New York City for over 25 years, I guess. And, you know, I'm thinking about these wonderful taverns, some of which are still in existence, you know, the White Horse and many others. But, you know, I'm thinking of coming to America, you know, these brewers who were making the beer, which probably tasted very different back then, but that it really was sort of this craft in the true sense of the word, industry. And the way you're describing it, it just is conjuring up all those images.
Yeah. And, you know, back before Prohibition and, you know, the people who were making beer then, they really brought it. They brought their culture with them. So the German, you know, the German culture, they would come here to the U.S. and that's, you know, where we get a lot of the beer styles that people would be most familiar with. But that happened. And even now we're seeing Italian style Americanized craft beer come up, which is really cool. We have a story on it right now. But it truly is culture and family. And yeah, it's by people who really are passionate and crafted for flavor on a smaller level.
Wow. Yeah. So they can hone in their skills. So by the nature of that, then this must have a maybe starting to see. I don't know if the association is tracking this and if you're reporting on it, but there must be an incredible economic impact, not only overall to the industry, which we can talk about in a minute, but specifically to the small towns and communities where these passionate beer makers with these brewers are working from. I mean, they have to employ people. They're renting space. Yes. They're, you know,
putting money right back into the communities. Absolutely. And that's the thing, too, that we've seen about craft beer. It's truly, you know, manufacturing when you think about it. So as craft brewing grows here in the U.S., it brings jobs back to small communities. The cool thing is we're also seeing revivals in, like, I live in the Rust Belt. And so cities like Pittsburgh and Cleveland and Detroit and Toledo, you know, you see wherever small breweries go, they tend to be part of a cultural revitalization because they bring people back to those areas. They bring manufacturing back to the areas. So it really does create an economic impact in our communities here in America.
Wow, I can see that. You know, I'm living in an area where I'm from, which is San Antonio in the Texas Hill Country, and that's between San Antonio and Austin, which is the wine country here. And you really do see agribusiness impacting the economy and impacting the culture and people being proud, particularly in this area, of their German heritage. So I can kind of see the parallel path of agribusiness hand in hand with brewing. I mean, there has to be some kind of economic impact, though, that this is having on kind of the non-craft. I don't want to say the big guys, and I also don't want to call them guys. I don't know how else to refer to sort of maybe the large corporate.
Yeah, the big beer.
Yeah. Okay, makers. Better. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I wouldn't say that craft is necessarily chipping too much into their bottom line at the end of the day, but that's also not necessarily the point. It's kind of an apples and oranges, but you know, craft beer itself, as of 2018, craft brewer sales made up about 13%.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, of the U.S. beer market by volume, and that equates to a little bit more than $27 billion of the U.S. beer market. And that it's a little bit more every year, which is great to see. Mm-hmm. But it's truly about, it's not about competing with the big beer companies. It's really truly about, you know, being that local place for your community to go, which is really, really what it's all about. And also about, you know, great beer.
Right.
And
right.
Exciting flavors. But yeah, and the economic impact that the craft breweries are having as a whole is about $80 billion.
Pretty amazing.
On the U.S. economy as a whole, and creating 150,000 jobs, U.S. workforce, and that's at breweries alone. So that doesn't even count like the agriculture, the farmers, mm-hmm. the maltsters that they touch, you know, as it goes throughout the chain.
So let's talk about that, because you just, you know, conjured up the name of this show, Grapes, Grains, and Grub, right? So it really is a handshake. You know, we can say it's the supply chain of what we consume, but it really is a handshake. We've had great interviews with distillers that talk about, you know, the relationships that they have with, of course, the farmers, because, you know, they need that to make their whiskey. So there's got to be some really interesting stories about farmers and brewers that sort of have locked arms and are creating great product.
The longer I do this job, the more that I see these great stories and these partnerships with farmers and brewers. Part of it is because brewers are trying to be as local as possible, right? Because you want to bring the flavor of the place you are into your beer. using local ingredients is absolutely one way you can do that. And they also, you know, it's small business supporting small business. Yeah. And of course, the green sustainability of it all, because you're sourcing ingredients closer to home. So you're not leaving as much of a footprint on the environment. Mm. So that's another benefit of brewers and farmers working together. One of my favorite stories that shows how they're working together is out of Arizona. And we published this a year or two ago, but about the Verde River in Arizona. It's a very important river for farmers, but also once it reaches the Phoenix metro area, it is becomes drinking water supply for about 2 million people there. But the river itself really dries out in the summer and struggles to thrive. But recently, the Nature Conservancy, a couple of Arizona craft brewers and Arizona farmers have figured out that if they plant barley instead of traditional crops like corn, it uses less water to grow the barley. So they've been able to, to truly work together, and then using the barley and the beer because the brewers want the local ingredients. It's this great way that they're able to bring life back to the river in times that it would normally be dry, simply by planting a small amount of a different crop. So I love and how they all got together to do it. I think it's so stinking cool.
It is. It is. I love that. And story. It's also like, once, you know, let's acknowledge, like, that's what can happen when there's not a giant amount of red tape. Right. So that's a community, a small business, caring individuals coming together to make something happen. I just hope that what's happening with craft beer in the culture of brewers is seeping into sort of the whole retail mentality, too. I mean, I know that customers don't always have the benefit of being able to go to a brewery that has a storefront, so to speak. I know there's some great ones here in the Hill Country, many great ones in the Hill Country that also have delicious food, you know, and you fill your growler and you're on your way. So if you don't have that opportunity to do something like that, what do you see happening at the retail level where you can go in and you see an assortment of beer? Is it hard for the craft brewers to kind of break into major retail, or is that something that's on the rise?
You know, I think it just depends on a business plan. Industry is changing so rapidly at the moment, because at this point we have more than 7,500 operating breweries in the U.S. So you've got to have a great business plan, and whatever that is for your brewery may be different from, you know, the brewery that's 10 miles away from you. So the tap room culture, and that's when you may not distribute a ton, if any, beer. But that's not the worst thing, because you're going to force people to come into your brewery to have that experience that you want them to have with your beer. And they can't just grab it at the grocery store.
So it's more experiential, and then you're able to sort of be in that environment, feel the culture, taste the flavor, and really fully experience. But then what if you go away and you go back to a different state, 5 states away? Like, how do you get your hands on that beer?
Trust me, we just moved from Atlanta a year ago, and I struggle with it.
Oh my gosh.
Day. So yeah, it's a toughie. But yeah, it can really just depend, like I said, on the business plan. And there's so many models out there that can work. But it depends what that individual brewery founder really wants to do with their brewery.
So, you know, our show is defined as a culinary destination show. That's how we define it, because we do believe that, you know, we always say plane, train, or automobile, just get there, you know. So I'm encouraging our listeners that, you know, you may want to go to the website and make sure that you read all these incredible stories that are there, because you could build a whole culinary destination around a craft brewery tour.
Oh, you sure can. We craft beer geeks call them beercations.
I love it. I love it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And there are some cities in the U.S. that are so great for beercations. And just speaking as a beer geek myself, if they're walkable, being walkable is super important. And if they've got a couple breweries that you can easily get to, whether walkable or via public transport, that can make for super beercation cities and great food cultures. Like Asheville is a great beercation destination. I believe that Grand Rapids, Michigan is another one that people will want to go to. And if you don't mind making a drive, and I think they still might have a brew bus, but it can go down to Kalamazoo as well, which isn't too far. You would not want to walk.
Right, right.
But yeah, there are so many cities that are finding that beer drive tourism. And so if the cities, both on a travel tourism destination marketing, but also on the level of laws that can support these small businesses, you can really see cities and downtowns thrive from craft brewers.
Well, we see that happening in Texas. We see that happening in New York, you know, the West, certainly. And with the association being based in Colorado, that's sort of square there in the middle. There must be a lot of interesting breweries just around that area as well, probably anywhere in the United States. I'm guessing. What I love that you're saying earlier is about the flavor that really reflects the area. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because to me, that's really a big differential than going to the store and sort of, you know, your grocery store or wherever you shop and you quickly grab a six pack and it's sort of the same flavor over and over again. And there is something to be said for consistency and flavor. But when you want something different and fun and to experiment, I mean, that's really fun.
Yeah, and that's what craft brewers in America, that's part of their heartbeat is truly the experimentation and doing fun things with old styles, making them new again, putting an American spin on them. The ingredients, and it really does tie back to localization. This reminds me of a story we published just last month about Florida breweries. And there have been some Florida breweries that are recently applying for a Fresh from Florida seal.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that Fresh from Florida seal used to be for Florida oranges only because the agriculture department down in Florida was trying to help the small growers market their products, and small farmers don't have the money to do their own marketing, but they thought, hey, let's create a seal for the small farmers in our state so that when people are like, I want Florida oranges, they know this is a Fresh from Florida orange. So now brewers are applying and getting that seal, and it doesn't have to be an orange, but when they're using Florida ingredients. So that's been pretty cool. And strawberries out of Plant City, Florida, that was an ingredient that we talked about. And the brewery, I wish I could remember their name, but they grew up around there. So they remember the strawberry festival every year. And they wanted to recreate that awesome memory from their childhood of Florida strawberries. So they use the Florida strawberries in their Florida
beer. Oh, I love
that
story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And Florida is actually, with all produce down in Florida, is basically available year round and always in season, more or less. So you'll see a lot of cool uses of produce in Florida beers, and everyone's doing it. New York State itself, they have a farm brewery designation, but the farm brewery doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be drinking beer by cows. It means that a certain percentage of the beer at the brewery is made using New York State ingredients. So it truly is about the place, about being local and supporting, and we go back to it again, but supporting other local businesses in and around you.
I love it. So it really, what I'm learning here today, and I'm sure our listeners are too, that it really is, this industry really is about a sense of place. It's like the taste and the experience of the sense of place, which I hadn't thought about before. So that is so cool. I'm loving it. So could we just talk about women in the craft beer industry, because I've read several articles where this is just on the rise. And just like if you look at the, for instance, the Land O'Lakes organization, that is an organization for, you know, farmers across America, they see an increasing rise of women farmers as part of their organization. So that has to be going hand in hand with craft beer.
Yeah, we're seeing more women. And it's not that there weren't any previously, but I think as the industry continues to grow and also the appeal of beer continues to grow, like me, I was a beer lover who now works in beer. So I think as the appeal for beer continues to grow and there's more breweries, more women are realizing, yeah, this is a career I can do and that I want to do. So we are seeing it grow. Now, the numbers aren't astronomical by any sense. And it's not that women weren't welcome before. Surprisingly enough, we had talked to some of the original women, pioneering women in beer in the 80s and the early 90s. And they all felt like just craft beer being craft beer. So the community and helping others and helping other brewers is pretty much a thing of why craft beer is craft beer. But the women said since they were entering craft beer, they didn't feel like they were, that they were embraced more so than had they been going into some other industry overall. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I love when people ask me about the women in beer, because I'm like, well, I'm a woman in beer. Now, I know I don't make the beer, but I know my boss is a woman in beer and a kick-ass woman in beer at that. So, and I have lots of friends who own breweries or co-own the breweries. Heck, even my beer group in Atlanta, there were more women than men in that. So it was real fun.
And marketing departments, you know, take note, because still women make the buy decision in the household. And I don't see that changing.
No.
Anytime soon.
I mean, yeah,
so women are in beer no matter what, right?
Yeah. Then that's even going back to some of the art and the beer marketing from even the 30s and 40s, you can see that the companies realized, oh, we need to appeal to women because they're the ones who are buying it. So they started to change the direction of how they would make that art that would sell the beer.
Well, you have such an interesting job, Jess Baker. Oh my gosh. You know, as a fellow journalist, I can tell you, you know, when you're leading a team and leading a industry, trying to tell stories as you guys do at craftbeer.com, you know, you want that deep well of content, so to speak. And you have stories that could go on for hundreds of years in your industry. It's so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And I am usually overwhelmed by story pitches from our authors and from our writers. And I wish I could take them all. But there's so many stories to tell out there. And I mean, the people, since when I was getting into beer as a beer lover, it was about the people, right? And so that's when I started at craftbeer.com. I really wanted to take the focus off the beer, because pretty much everyone has an IPA and, you know, everyone kind of has a stout. But the thing is each of those people, what drives them to be in beer? What drives them to run a brewery? That's what I thought was so interesting. I'd go on brewery tours and everyone has a brewery tour, but I'd hear from these founders and these brewers about why they were in love with yeast or what was so magical about beer to them. And I'd get chills and I was like, okay,
I love it. Oh my gosh.
I should tell these people stories. So yeah, I never run out of being inspired by the people who make the magic happen.
Well, that's wonderful. And it surely shows. Everyone, please, you know, go to craftbeer.com. I would say, listeners, even if you're not totally a beer geek like Jess is, but who's mad about beer. But if you have any interest in the stories behind it, they really do take some wonderful deep dives into the personalities, the localities, everything having to do with the industry. And it really is revealing about who we are as a nation and the communities. And it's just interesting, is all I can say, all the way around. Jess, I'm so happy that you joined us today on Grapes, Grains, and Grub, and continued success. And I'm sure we will be checking back in with you over time, because there's so many, like you said, this industry is growing so incredibly quickly. So there is going to be news to tell, I'm sure.
Yes, please do reach back out. It was really great to talk about something I love so much with you today, Cecily. So thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. And best wishes, because Jess is a new mom. And last note, are you going to be publishing any lists or any stories on family-friendly breweries?
So we've got a couple, but I think 2020 may be the year of really exploring parenting and beer, because it's a topic both me and my assistant editor, he's a new dad. So we're very passionate about breweries young kids. So I think you'll see more in 2020.
Okay. All right, my dear. Have a great day. And everybody, this has been Jess Baker. She is the editor-in-chief of craftbeer.com. Whether it's a plane, a train, or an automobile, make your way to this culinary destination.
Okay, so this week, we're excited about this really cool destination. It's Alpine, Texas. Now, Alpine is a small town in the gorgeous Big Bend country of Far West Texas. There's a ton of culture packed into this casual, laid-back destination. It's part university town, part artist mecca, and part live music legend. There are many local cafes, restaurants, and bars with menus that seem to fit the venue's vibe. It's known for preserving its original architecture from the 18 to early 1900s. You may be strolling through a gallery, a honky-tonk, an artist space, or vinyl. Yeah, I said vinyl, record store, with food, libations, and live music at every turn. Look for the restaurants that honor the incredible exterior and interior murals that Alpine is known for, and ask to see their private art collections. There's some really cool ones. From West Texas-style Mexican food to barbecue to upscale menus and relaxed dining rooms, you can walk your way through downtown Alpine and experience a whole lot of delicious culture at our pick for this Grapes, Grains, and Grub culinary destination.
And now, here's Cecily's picks.
Okay, here are my picks. So right now, I'm madly in love again with Ace Perry Cider. I don't know if you guys are cider drinkers. I've been a cider drinker for a long time. And one of my favorite kinds of cider is pear cider. Okay, so in 1996, this company called Ace released Perry Cider. Now, the difference is this is made from actual Perry pears. It's super light, super refreshing, and it's a little champagne-like with a dry finish, and I just absolutely love it. So this cider business was founded in the 1970s by a guy called Jeffrey House, who moved here from the UK. He had this long distance love with his girlfriend, Angela. She finally moved to the US and they got married, and they found themselves in the orchards of Sonoma County, and they opened up the Ace Cider, which is California's original cider mill. And what I love too is that it's gluten-free and it's really, really good with spicy food, which of course brings me to my next item. So I'm a big fan and I use in my own cooking all the time. I use smoked paprika, and people ask me about it, and I have realized over time that there's really bad smoked paprika out there, and then there's so many different varieties, but really Spanish smoked paprika is where you want to go. So there is a website called tienda.com, T-I-E-N-D-A.com, and it's a family in Williamsburg, Virginia, and they had lived in Spain during the 70s, and they founded this company that basically curates and distributes products that they love from Spain. And I mean, it's amazing. It's really, really, really good. The kind that I love the most is called Pimentón de la Vera. And we'll put that on the website, of course. And it comes from the region of Extremadura, which is super earthy, yummy, yummy flavors. Okay, so now my next and final pick drumroll please, has nothing to do with cider or paprika. Okay, so there's a company I'm in love with called Hippie Snacks. Hippie, as in H-I-P-P-I-E, snacks. And they have this one crisp, if you will. They said they started making it because they were distributing snacks and all kinds of products, and it was like to combat these boring tortilla chips. Anyway, it is their avocado crisps, sea salt. So what I love about this company is their motto and what they do are minimally processed snacks. These crisps are made with avocado, pumpkin seeds, and sea salt, and pretty much that's it. There's very few ingredients, but they're just so damn good. They're also doing their business in an ethical and environmentally responsible way, which is nice. It's nice to have really yummy food that you feel good about eating. So all three of these picks today come from small businesses that blew up because their products were so good. A lot of them are from the 70s, and why not? I am too. So I'm all about it. By the way, these are my picks. I'm not paid to do these things. These are products that I really, really love, and I hope you do too. All right, so those are my quick picks right there, off the cuff, but all the information with the pictures, the links, everything you need to know to find out more about these picks of mine are on grapesgrainsgrub.com. Those were some fun picks, if I do say so myself. If you have a product, destination, idea, or location you want us to know about, just go to our site for all the many, many ways to contact us. We really would love to hear your picks. And you know, you might just hear them on the show. I just loved doing the research and interviews for this episode. I always learn something. I hope you do too. You know, I grew up in South Texas, Acapulco, Mexico, and the Texas Hill Country, which is located between San Antonio and Austin. And when I moved to New York City to follow my dream of becoming a writer many, many years ago, it opened up a culinary world where the kind of farm, ranch, and ocean-sourced ingredients I had grown up eating were taken to a whole new level. With so many talented chefs and gastronomists who I've had the great fortune, I mean, I can't even believe it, to interview throughout my career. You will meet many of them on this season of the Grapes, Grains, and Grub audio show, and you really can get to know them even better on our website, where you will find behind-the-scenes pictures and more. Our social media accounts are at Grapes, Grains, Grub. Our hashtag is Agriculture Tastes Good. And do please sign up for our newsletter because it's not your normal newsletter. We really do have some truly different offers and experiences. Until we meet again on your favorite audio platform, please make an effort to buy your food as close to the source as possible and start a conversation with the butcher and veggie department people at your local market. I'm so grateful for you listening, so we keep bringing you these candid conversations with these really dedicated people who fill our plates, bellies, and souls. I'm Cecily Armstrong, and I'm having a dry Tito's vodka martini to kick off my evening. A flash-fried spinach salad with grilled quail from the Diamond H Ranch in the Texas Hill Country, and a sweet potato mash for dinner. What are you having? Let me know before next week's episode. Adios.
The Grapes, Grains, and Grub Show is produced by Nitex Productions. Nitex Studios Originals. The executive producer is Cecily Armstrong. Producer, Stephanie Locke. Associate producer is Polly Moore and the fine folks at Nitex Studios. Theme music and original composition by Frank Castro.